food channels running there?
Well, there's none here. Mm-hmm. We don't monkey with it here.
Okay, this is just in your bonded insulation.
On the bonded, yeah. Okay. Wherever it was bonded, we purchased.
Mm-hmm. Are there just little ducts that were in there?
Machined in, uh-huh. Hmm.
We had this prefabricated insulation honeycomb that we then put these ducts, machine ducts, and then had channels, manifolds and channels that would distribute helium that would cause a uniform purge. That kept the insulation from, as I say, cryopumping air and freezing air inside the insulation, which it would do. And interestingly enough, when you get off the ground and start, you rise so rapidly, it didn't outgas fast enough, you see. It still had that helium in there at a pressure that was diminishing less than atmospheric pressure is diminishing. So we had some what we call pasties that we had on many ports. Just at liftoff, the first action is to tear off the pasties so it would give these channels of means of outgassing mm-hmm. unwanted pressure helium in the insulation. These are some of the things that, you know, they don't sound like much, but if you don't do it right, they can just bug the daylights out of you as you start to go into operation. I guess probably another significant thing about the S2 was the amount of testing that we did, both at the component level, the system level, I should say the subsystem level, and then the complete system level. And to augment this program, we had the battleship, which was the really an engine test stage, permitted us to cluster the hydrogen engine. And this was followed by what we referred to as the all systems vehicle, the flight weight but never to be launched stage. Tested
it.
The all systems bird, we had an odd way of getting our stages off the stand. We would demolish them. And we proceeded to demolish the all systems bird. It kind of happened in a...
Was this a destructive test purposely?
No, we didn't really want to blow it up.
Okay.
We found out a great deal about it, though. We found out that the old problem that was to rear its head very large in the whole space business world was fracture mechanics. We found through some of the metallurgical work that I just think our metallurgical experts here really ought to be given a special medal, because they were able to take the pieces and do the detective work that said, not only here's where the failure occurred, here's the direction that the failure propagated, and they were able to put the whole thing back together and tell us then that we needed to increase our vigilance for inspecting wells and find any minute fracture that might become an incipient failure. So we learned a great deal by the fact that, okay, we lost the all systems bird, but we learned that, hey, you better really look for these cracks. And as a matter of fact, at the same time, we instigated a pneumatic pressure test that was done over on the Navy site. We pressurized these things to a proof pressure. And did one other thing. We did a cryogenic proof pressure, because there were those experts in the country that said the susceptibility to failure is increased as you decrease the temperature. Okay, the apparent aluminum may get stronger, but if it has an inherent weak spot in a weld, maybe that's not as strong at the depressed temperatures. So we did a cryogenic proof test at Mississippi, added that. So with all of this, we Well, of course, then there was the facility checkout stage that was used at the Cape, you know. And the dynamic test vehicle that was used at Mississippi in the total stack, you know, along with the first stack, the stage and the third stage in Apollo.
What was the first test vehicle called when we did down the Cape?
That was the facilities. Uh-huh. Facilities.
Are these covering the contract?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This one, you'll build 15 flyable, but you'll also build...
We built a static test article, which we broke up. I say we had a very interesting way of removing the stages from the stand. We built the all-systems bird. We built the battleship, which is well named because it was steel, an inch, stainless steel, an inch thick. We built the dynamic test article. And then we built several, we built a common bulkhead cryogenic test article to test it at the reduced temperature. Failed it. And then because of wanting to really get added confidence in our structure, we built the so-called mini stages. And they were shorter segments of the tankage and bulkhead. And there was the mini A, B, and C, which were just the real critical portions of our tank structure.
Now, this all-system stage, that was the one that was demolished at Mississippi.
And the structures test, we were within just fraction of percentage points from the element when we failed it. That's where you got to be. If you're gonna design a zero margin, you keep the weight down.
Don't you have a design margin on the vehicle? About 0.5, something like that?
Well, you have 25%. 25%. See, we operate, let's say we operate it, if our factor is operating is 1, because we test it, it can fail at 1.25.
Mm-hmm. You're about 1.24 at the turn of the trigger.
Yeah, something like that. And that's one small piece. I remember when we got it in the stand, somebody sent me a picture of it. It used to be missiles and rockets. I don't know if it's Aviation Week now or not. They sent me the cover of it. That was April 19, 1965.
Was that this big stand down here at Seal Beach?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one that was the hydrostatic test? You had water in it?
Yeah, we had water in it for the purpose that, you know, it isn't like a bomb. When we did the pneumatic test, we would move over on the Navy side because if that thing blew, of course, it'd be just a virtual bomb. Mm-hmm. But they figured the hazardous area, and they did clear that area. And then they pump it up. So we really had, I think, a very complete program that gave all concerned the confidence that when we stood up and said, we're ready to fly, we had statically fired the thing, we had tested it at cryogenic temperatures, we had gone through a whole lot of backup tests of the structure, and in the true sense, there could be no unexplained failures. In other words, when a failure occurred, you really had to say, here's what happened, and here's our fix, and it is fixed because. Mm-hmm. And it had to satisfy the astronauts, and it had to satisfy Dr. Von Braun, Dr. Reed, Dr. Miller, the whole top NASA organization. We had really two severe critics, but the reason the thing is so successful today.
How in the did you work with MSFC, Don Brown and Reese and these people? How often did they suggest things to you? Did they try to help you in some of your design?
Yeah, they did. They'd have many times they'd have a parallel design going down there, and frequently we would come up with a combined solution to a problem. In other words, it would be their metallurgists plus ours, or some of their people that were good on adhesives, or some of their people doing either cooperative or independent work, that provided this confidence of that system is good, it's ready to go, or solve problems, so help us solve the problems that occur. That are natural to occur when you're developing, and this was really developing. We had to go in there with a high confidence that things were going to work. We couldn't go like the old missile programs where the government bought 35 missiles and they expected you to clobber all of them, or very few successes for one for the number of failures.
Well, I'm still interested in examining the relationship between you and MSFC. Now, were they helpful in pointing out some of your difficulties with scheduling and production, or were you supplying them with most of the information?
Well, so far as the technique is concerned, they got to a point where they had a format which they finally wanted. Data reported, and as that gelled, then we reported our data in that format. The contract called for PERT initially, and PERT was a little cumbersome because it to really get the PERT program so it would, in a timely fashion, report the problems. Is only a tool, and it needs a lot of other things, in my view. But we reported pretty much in the way the government wanted the information. It wasn't until, though, well into the program that it smoothed out to, I think, what I'd call a real good system. There was a lot of learning going on in how the government should track and what the contractor should supply in terms of information, so that you'd know in a timely way how the hell is the program really going, you know. And as I say, we all tended to underestimate the complexity of the S2, and it tended to make all concerned a bit more optimistic about how long it would take to do a job. How much it costs to do a job. And this became resolved as we moved along. We had to, where problems would occur, we'd have to mutually decide, well, we've got to solve that problem, and it's going to cost about this much, or we better take this method plus a backup method, you know. And go with two until we can see a little ray of hope here, and then chop the other one off and go with the solution that looks best, that looks most promising. Well, that method was only used where the problems were, you know, pretty tough. Mm-hmm. I mentioned one common market. Mm-hmm. Some of the valves we had backup sources. Sometimes we would abandon a supplier right in midstream. The insulation, we abandoned it. We cut him off. Mm-hmm. Our vent valves, we abandoned them. We abandoned the original source and went to a new source, Calmec.
Did that cost you anything to get out of that contractually? Or?
Oh, no. We were bailing them out a little bit until such time as they saw what was terms of the contract. Mm-hmm. So, the government having paid for all that information, all of it was available to the guy who was going to pick it up from there. Mm-hmm. And so they had the full advantage of mistakes to that point. I think it cost a little time, but it's the better judgment to not put good money after bad if we see that someone isn't going to be able to solve the problem. And with a vent valve, you've got problems of leakage. It's got to react rapidly to vent tanks at a very rapid rate to prevent explosions. Then they've got to close again and not leak. And some of these response times and leakage rates and performance just couldn't be met by Leonard, who was the original source of valves. And Kalmick picked it up. And they did, I thought, a very remarkable job of making back some of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think with another one, I was trying to see our main, not our pre-valve. We abandoned. Here's the case where our Los Angeles division was in the pre-valve and we decided to go to Parker. So here, rather than us, North American bailing them off, we looked to Parker to take over from our Crenshaw plant, who'd had a lot of still built a lot more valves for us. Not mm-hmm. that particular one. Mm-hmm. They just weren't having all that much success in solving the problem. And here they were tolerance problems. Mm-hmm. Once depressed to those temperatures, they wasted a great big butterfly valve, 8 inches like that. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't seat once. Of course, our tests were terrible. We cycled and cycled and cycled, and then they'd have to seat and seal. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't quite get that thing properly. Power it took to cycle it was too high. There's a whole lot of problems. And
it would warp maybe when the temperature changed.
Right. The shaft would distort a little bit. And the power to overcome this. And it had to fail in a certain way. Mm-hmm. See, it would have to, certain valves would fail open, certain valves would fail closed. Mm-hmm. And so these added extra complexities to the valve design. There again, they really did, I think, a yeoman job in making up some of the time loss. We had to pull certain of the cryogenic lines out of some of the suppliers and put them over with Solar. Solar tended to be our best source of cryogenic. These are vacuum jacketed lines. And they're tough. Have to sit there forever and a day and never leak. The vacuum can't degenerate. And they're very, very lightweight. Got an awful flap about weld offset. Here are these very, very thin metals. Putting them together, here, maybe 10 inches. Visualize that having to be perfectly lined up all the way around. Mm-hmm. A little offset was like this, see? So our tolerance on offset was just out of this world. What? With proper tooling, we finally got it,
Well, wasn't that the case with the big 33-foot diameter tank?
And we had
expansion problems.
Sure, right. And we
put those things together?
Yeah, we finally got the proper solution with our backup bars, our heat sinks, and proper clamping. And of course, part of the problem too was contamination. Gosh, when we first started the weld, they were still building the building down there. So mm-hmm. you take one part weld metal, two parts paint, and one part dust, and that doesn't make the greatest weld in the world because the Navy was a little behind getting the iron buildings built. So finally, we
Navy
had.
Built the building?
Huh?
Navy built the building?
Sure, that's on Navy property. The Navy deeded that land to NASA. But also was the Bureau of Yards and Docks. If it's the Army Corps of Engineers, well, the Bureau of Yards and Docks are a lot like the Army Corps of Engineers. They really built that. So the Navy guys were in charge, and they hired the contractors. It was merely to our requirements, which the NASA approved. So our facilities guys, you see, they would draw up the requirements for those buildings. But the engineers, my guys, would say, well, we've got to do this, this, and this, and then the tooling guys would get in there. And then we would hand this group of specs over to the Bureau of Yards and Docks, and they would execute those contracts. And there was a hell of a lot there, you know. Here we got you got a new design, new facility, new problem, tight schedule. Gonna go to the moon in this decade, man. That was, of course, the great pressure to keep everything on schedule as close as schedule.
Is everybody pleased with this decision to go to the moon within the decade? I mean,
everybody.
Rather go more leisurely. Question I've never asked before.
I don't know really how to answer that, because it was such a big decision. The president made it, you know, and so everybody was dedicated. Nobody really questioned it. The thing that really was difficult for people to realize was that there are variables. If you're going to hold schedule, then you got to up the overtime and pour in more money.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you hold both of these back and assume reasonable efficiency. Or if the guy's a dog, you got to get him out of there anyway. But if you assume reasonable efficiency and hold back on the money, hold back on the overtime for some reason, then the schedule's a variable. You can't have everything. And it took us all quite a while to get that in its proper context.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the first flight dates, what was actually done, you'd say, oh my God. And you just blew it. But still got it in this decade. So the president's commitment was achieved. We didn't fly as many. 1970, as the original plans called for.
Well, probably the original plans were for testing. They were going to test this before the OLS.
Then when, of course, Miller came along, when Bernard Holmes was in it, there were a certain number that was set aside for tests. But when Miller came along and the OLS policy, that said, go for broke.
Of course, that really saved a tremendous amount of money.
I guess the thing that bugs me the most, if you're interested in that, you probably aren't, but what the country has always looked for either a major war or presidential proclamation or the war for jets, the war for rockets, the war for nuclear energy, a presidential proclamation that we're going to the moon. What we never seem to do is get a minister of or a secretary of technology to start to lay out a 2, 5, 10-year program that says, this is the way this country is going. We're not going to drop the ball technically, nor are we going to require a yo-yoing of the funds that doesn't permit sensible planning of the space program. And until a country does that, in hell, $3.5 billion, if they stopped it, we get the guys that are shouting humanities, they wouldn't see that much difference. And I'll get off my stump, but I believe that, and I believe until the country recognizes it, we're going to get yo-yoed around budget-wise. And if I ever have nothing to do, I think I may just go beat the tub for a secretary of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the countries in the world are smart enough to do it, including the Russians.
That was very big in the 20s. Engineers wanted to get a cabinet level director of public works to
do a
dissertation on American civil engineering.
Sure. You don't look that old.
We've had this thing. We had the Vannevar Bush and the SRD.
They've been nipping around the edges of it. Advisors, sure.
But
it's like
Nixon's going to go the other route. He's going to cut down the cabinet.
That's the way it looks.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The same darn thing right now. You got EPA and these various things on ecology and pollution. Until there's a goddamn window that you can walk up to saying, here's my proposal, Mr. Government. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy that says, yeah, we've got these requirements and we're going to go from here to here in this length of time. Forget it, except Mother Hubbard down here that's going to raise hell because somebody's dumping pollution in the bay.
Oceanography is real big now. It's no fun.
No fun.
Well, I have two friends, instrumentation physicists. They want to go out in a two-man sub and instrument it for what needs to be done. They can't get any money to do that.
Can't get any money. There are some great ideas. Mm-hmm. This company, North American, still has some marvelous ideas, but to really exploit them at the right level. I've got a young stalwart son that's in oceanography right now, and he's got a discrete level opening, a sample taker. Mm-hmm. Right now, the oceanographer goes out there and grabs samples, which he should have, because he gets temperature, salinity, and all these good things that tell us about what's affecting things, mm-hmm. and what's growing down there. What they do, they run a sampler down there, and it gets everything from any level. Mm-hmm. And he's got a discrete opening and closing thing. Can't get any money to do that. He's with USSC down here. Actually, it's created by the National Science Foundation. But doggone it, just burns me up that we don't get a technology administrator that really does something. So my parting shot is not really. I think NASA handled it great compared to what I see a lot of other people doing. True, they might have borrowed a hell of a lot more from the Air Force and gotten with it a little faster, but I'm not here to criticize them for that. I don't think they got with it, and the industry did, and without the two, the way it worked, nothing would have happened. I'm just afraid that they've got to learn the NASA or whatever you want to call it.
What was your biggest problem when you were managing the SU?
Well, I've mentioned some of them. Yeah. We kind of staggered several problems. I think probably one of our biggest problems was to realistically. There are people who have statistically said is your you're going to develop and plot it over the years what it's going to take. I won't believe them. Now we have accurately and plot it over the years what it's going to take. Now we have pitching jobs. People like that in our corporate office were able to do that. And when we do a realistic part of the world, senators, they'll all we have one. think it was one of my family.
Thank you.